first the experiment was done with long pulses. Now they repeated the experiment with short pulses to get rid of that ambiguity. Step by step, they've gone through each one of the ambiguities, and there's 20 parts per million of extra speed of the neutrinos keeps coming up, yes, and it's confirmed. I've got a theory on this one, Fred, and that is the amount of empty space. If you've seen that program on Nova called The Fabric of the Cosmos, and they talk about the one that has empty space, a slight variation of that was, I forget where I was reading it, let me drop it. Take an ordinary oxygen molecule, which is really something like one angstrom in diameter. Well, let's blow it up in size. Let's blow it up in size to something that's really big. And that big thing that we blow it up to is the Wembley Stadium in London, which has a circumference of 1 kilometer. It's got a diameter of something like 300 feet, if I got it right. Yeah, 300 feet in diameter. So I'm going to blow up a oxygen atom so that it is 300 feet in diameter of the outer electron shell. Now it's got a nucleus. The nucleus has got 8 protons and 8 neutrons. That nucleus in the center of this great big football stadium is 1.25 inches in diameter for the whole darn nucleus. And now you talk about one of those protons or neutrons in that nucleus. One of those protons is 1/8 of an inch diameter. So you have this huge stadium, a zillion cubic meters of stuff, which is all empty space, and you got that little bit of a hard nucleus in the center, and these tiny little protons and neutrons make up that nucleus, and everything in between is perfect vacuum empty space. Each individual atom is that empty. According to that program, you take the whole darn Empire State Building with all of its steel, glass, concrete, stone, and everything else, and take out all the empty space of all of those molecules of the Empire State Building, and it would be approximately a grain of wheat on your hand. That would be the size of all the stuff. It'd be 500 million pounds, but you take out all the empty space, it would be a grain of wheat. So as you can see, matter as you and I know it, solid matter, is mostly empty space. You take something called neutrino, which has essentially zero charge and essentially zero mass. It can wander through all of that empty space without hitting anything. On average, a neutrino has no trouble going through the whole diameter of the Earth without hitting anything. Detecting them is a real dog of a problem. Very rarely do they hit something. You got to send out a whole lot of them before a few of them hit something and you can get a detection. So because they move so freely through matter, does that explain how they move with extra speed? No. But I think the way you measure their speed when they go through matter makes them look real fast. When they go through empty space, you're saying that the coincidence of the neutrino beam and the extra light and X-ray and everything else that you saw from that supernova was essentially coincident. Was there really zero time delay between the neutrino beam and everything else that was emitted by that supernova that was detected, Fred? Was there at least a little bit of differential in time? And were they smart enough to know to look for it at that time? K1FC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, when this was firing off, there should have been 4 years difference, not a little bit. In other words, there is some, and also if the, also theoretically, if they were going faster, they would have should have shown an energy loss, which they didn't. So that's why they're kind of scratching their heads. They haven't really figured out exactly what. So maybe it's because something has a coefficient of I'm blank on a common term, index of refraction, that somehow or other that just an index of the light flows down going through a substance that somehow or other that for neutrinos you have a negative index of refraction. Now this is a cockamamie theory that I just came up with, which has no theoretical physical basis, it's pure conjecture. but right now they're still trying to figure out why it doesn't match up with previous observations at all. K1FC.
There's been a whole lot of articles in the last 5 years or so, Fred, on what are called meta-materials, M-E-T-A materials. You take the right kind of a crazy-looking circuit made out of what looks like printed circuit material, but it's a whole lot of step-and-repeat pattern, and you do it just right. You can synthesize a material which has negative index of refraction. Now, when a beam of energy enters this material, instead of it bending toward the normal, it bends away from the normal, as if the material had a velocity of propagation that's faster than the speed of light. I didn't say it did. By the way, when you send a signal down a waveguide, the group velocity is always much, much less than the speed of light, but the phase velocity is much greater than the speed of light. The product of the two, by the way, is the speed of light. So the phase velocity of a signal going down a waveguide is faster than the speed of light. Craziness. Now, a waveguide is not a metamaterial. So synthesizing materials that have negative index of refraction, that's been done, and believe it or not, one of the projects I was on used some of that material. One of the antennas that I've worked on is a quasi-metamaterial where the antenna has a hell of a lot more bandwidth by 5-to-1 ratio compared to what the good laws from Chu and Wheeler. Mr. Chu and Mr. Wheeler told you how much bandwidth you're going to get out of a small-sized antenna. And I've come up with an antenna that seems to be exceeding that rule by a whole lot. We'll eventually find out what's really going on. But it's a nice antenna, which, by the way, not only is a patent application on the antenna, but it's also a product being manufactured as we speak. And it's on the front end of a handheld RFID reader. So, speed of light and the velocity of propagation and whatever. Don't think we know everything there is to know about it yet. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So when you said it should have been 4 years earlier, is that a fairly recent article, Fred, where the neutrino experiment between Italy and CERN was 20 parts per million faster? If I take 20 parts per million and use it to the distance to that particular supernova, is that what comes out 4 years ahead? Is that the ratio? K1FC, wait for all four beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that was what was reported. That was that if you use that ratio over the distance that they were talking about, there should have been a 4 year separation, and there wasn't. Yeah, I have heard of better materials. I think it was one of the proposals for one of these cloaks of invisibility type things. But so far, they have invisibility cloaks. They have things that cloaks are things that you can hardly see anyhow. But it's a very interesting concept. But yes, I have heard of them, and was aware that they were being used. That the concept was being used. It was the only thing I could think of, though, that, you know, if positive index refraction slows things down, then a negative one, and how going through the material it went through did it, and whether we should be able to observe neutrinos if we could have bursts by having two detectors on opposite sides of the Earth or something. I have no idea what that would show. But we are due for a paradigm shift in physics. You know, we've got all these mysteries of exactly what is dark matter, for example, the dark energy, and all sorts of convoluted ideas. And I think we're due for a big breakthrough that will unravel these things sometime in the next 50 years. Back to you, K1FC.
Now, let me show you a mystery that's even closer to home that you and I have personally experienced. We all talk about the maximum usable frequency of the ionosphere. And the ionosphere is a plasma, the fourth state of matter. In other words, the ultraviolet rays coming out of the sun beat down on the upper atmosphere, disassociate some of those electrons from some of those molecules, and you end up with a plasma. And depending on what is the maximum usable frequency today and the status of that ionosphere, and the angle of our signal and the frequency of our signal, you do get what you and I call an ionospheric bounce, but it's not a bounce. It's a refraction. If you really study with a little bit more closeness of what's going on, that signal enters the ionosphere at a grazing angle and gets bent downward by a refractive process. It looks like a bounce, but it's really refraction. And in order for that wave to be refracted downward, that means the portions of the wave that are deeper into the ionosphere are moving faster than the portions that are in the more shallow portion of the ionosphere. Does that mean that the upper portion of the wave is moving faster than the speed of light? Or does it mean the lower portion of the wave, in the more tenuous portion of the ionosphere, is moving slower than the speed of light? You would think that the lower surface of that ionosphere, where it's very tenuous, you would think that the wave entering there is traveling very close to the speed of light, and the portion of the wave deeper into the ionosphere, where the plasma is thicker, is more dense, is moving faster. So in order to get that downward bend, that refraction, the portion going through the ionosphere, the deeper portion of it, would have to move faster in order to be bent downward. Of course, that sounds crazy, but have you ever heard of a good explanation of how the ionosphere does what it does? K1FC after four beeps, K2RIW.
You got me, Dick. I've never given it any thought. That's something I'll have to look into. See if I can find anything. You may have hit upon a good point, though. This is KLFC.
Yeah, the whole idea of the TechNet is to answer questions, and lately we're coming up with more questions than we got answers. Oh, well. One last call, John. Are there any other of the Mel's Corner questions that you think we should approach now before we get into the serious stuff? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, we covered the two real questions. I don't get 50 or 300 like Mel, but the few that I got, these were the two important ones that had to be covered. Guys asking really basic questions that could be answered, and I'm sure their understanding is at a level, and you covered it. So that completes Mel's Corner for this week. Maybe I'll have something next week.
Yeah, there's a whole section of the latest questions that we get in the Radio Amateurs question pool for the volunteer examiner questions on the subject of radio frequency biohazard. And from my point of view, it's good to be conservative and to be on the safe side, but the 99.9% of the things that amateurs do, radio frequency biohazard-wise, are safe. You have to really work at it to do something that's not safe. I will admit that if you put 100 watts into a very point source antenna, a corner reflector antenna at 432 or 1296 megacycles, and you stand a foot away from that thing and look and stare right into it, yeah, you're pushing your luck. That's a real concentrated source. But take that exact same corner reflector antenna with 1,000 watts going into it. Use it as the feed horn to a dish. Let's say a 28-foot diameter dish, and that's the feed horn. And it's a practical feed horn for that dish. And now the dish gives you 29 dB of gain. And you stand in front of the dish. You've now got, let's call it 30 dB of gain to be round off the numbers. 1,000 to 1 more gain out of the dish when you feed the feed horn into the dish as opposed to looking at the feed horn directly. And now you stand in front of that dish. Common sense would lead you to believe you're 1,000 to 1 less safe standing in front of the dish. It's the exact opposite. Let me drop. Because you got to obey the law of conservation of energy. That feed horn is smearing all of that energy across that 28-foot diameter dish, which is 625 square feet of area. You're smearing that kilowatt of energy across 600 square feet. And then that signal comes bouncing off the dish as a planar wave, a focused planar wave, focused at infinity. But in your near-field area, it's a planar wave intercepting you. You, the human being, are about 1 square meter of area, which is, you know, a very small percentage of the area of the whole dish. You intercept very little of the energy. The antenna, the high-gain antenna, is safer than a low-gain antenna when you're up close. Opposite of common sense. Who the heck would ever believe that? But it's the way radio really behaves. It's the way light behaves. It's the way energy that's being focused really behaves. So a hell of a lot of the things that we do are really safe. If you're putting 1,000 watts into an 80-meter dipole, and the 80-meter dipole is strung 6 feet off the ground in your backyard, and you stand right at the center of that dipole with 1,000 watts going into it, key down, with a brick on the Morse code key, and you stand 1 foot away from that antenna, the possibility exists when you go through the mathematics that it's actually safe, as crazy as that sounds. Let me drop. Because that 80-meter dipole is, by definition, if it's resonant, half-wave resonant, is 132 feet long. You're smearing that RF energy across 132 feet of wire. And the high voltage portions of it are way out at the tips of the wire, not at the center. You've got a strong magnetic field in the center, but a strong electrostatic field at the tips. And if you stood 1 foot away from that antenna at 80 meters with a kilowatt into it, there's two or three reasons why it's probably safe. Number one, you're smearing the energy across 132 feet, and you're just standing near a couple of feet of it. Number two, the magic of a frequency as low as 80 meters is that most of the RF energy hitting a human being at that frequency goes through with no effect. When the frequency is low enough, the RF energy goes through without any real effect. Believe it or not, the most dangerous frequency region is the VHF region, 30 to 300. That's the most dangerous region, 30 megs to 300 megs, because the majority of the energy at that frequency hitting you gets absorbed and turned into heat. Beyond 300 megs, when you get to 1,000 megs and above, 20% penetrates and 80% reflects off the skin. So 80% of it bounces off of you. So it's really crazy. When you look at the whole frequency spectrum, I call it through you, in you, and off you. The lowest frequency, most of it goes through you with no effect. The middle frequency is the VHF region. Most of it sticks in you and gets turned into heat. Above that, most of it bounces off you. So frequency-wise, low, medium, high, I call it through you, in you, off you. So at 80 meters, you got a whole lot of safety factors. To really get yourself in trouble, to turn down the transmitter with 1,000 watts into it for 6 solid minutes, stand close enough, and at a frequency where you're absorbing enough of it, you'd have to really work at it.
Repeater. Time out. Repeater.
Time. US-to-S.
All right, Paul, recognize. There are guys that are afraid to operate with their 2-meter antenna in the living room when they're in the dining room, if you know what I mean. And they're putting 50 watts into it. You'd be amazed how safe that is. Again, you'd have to be awfully close to get yourself in trouble. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, the last part of what you said could be confusing to some. The bouncing off part of your skin, where earlier, you know, a half hour ago, you're saying that, like, the ionosphere, the signal's not bouncing off of it, it's refracting. So is it really refracting off your skin, or is it bouncing off your skin? Back to you.
Now, that's a tough one, Paul. As you go to a really low frequency, like 3 megacycles, the RF energy goes right through you, and very little of it stays and gets absorbed. At the 30 to 300 megacycle region, a high percentage is absorbed and turned into heat, and the main thing that happens as you go from 30 megs to higher and higher frequencies is that the depth of penetration gets smaller and smaller. At 30 megacycles, I don't know the exact number, but of the RF energy hitting a human being at 30 megs, I'm going to make a guess that it penetrates 3 or 4 centimeters. As you go to 1,000 megacycles, I'm going to guess that the depth of penetration is a fraction of 1 centimeter and above. So the depth of penetration is smaller, and the percentage that stays there without bouncing off or reflecting off or refracting off, however you want to call it, 20% stays in the human being, and 80% of it no longer stays in the human being by coming back out of the front surface of the human being when you're above 1,000 megacycles. So the so-called microwave region that everybody shakes in their boots, they're positive that the word microwave means cancer. You stand in front of any zoning board and you say that that antenna I'm putting up is a microwave antenna. Oh, everybody in the room will suck in the air and say, oh, that person's doing something dangerous. We got to stop him. Pound for pound, microwaves are 5-to-1 safer than VHF frequencies. Ain't that crazy? VHF, UHF. So, an awful lot of what we feel and think about radio energy is more emotional than reality. It's more of a vocabulary problem. As you've heard me say so many times, the vocabulary problem would have gone away if the engineers and...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out.
If the engineers in the beginning of this century had decided to call it radio transmission and radio emission and radio signaling, they'd give it those words as opposed to RF radiation. Perfectly good word. Radiation means the signal spreads out in all directions after it comes off that antenna. Yes, it does radiate, and the process is radiation. Perfectly good word until nuclear radiation came along. And there's essentially nothing in common between nuclear radiation and radio radiation. But you try to explain that to people who have not very much scientific background, and you'll get a lot of pushback and a lot of flack. I wish we had a lot more science literacy in this country. Science and math literacy. It's needed. Because we fear a bunch of things that we shouldn't fear, and we don't fear a bunch of things that we should. You'd be amazed how many people are positive they don't want a nuclear power station in the same county with them because it's dangerous. But that exact same person will drive their child to school in their automobile and not worry about whether or not the child has a seatbelt on. The seatbelt scenario is 1,000 times more or 1,000,000 times more likely to create injury to the child than the nuclear power station that's in the same county with them. The risk assessment is something that's highly misunderstood. So there's a lot of very innocent things that we used to do, smoking cigarettes and not using seatbelts, which are very dangerous procedures. Certain foods that we eat are very dangerous as far as overall health in the long term is concerned. And yet it looks very innocent, and you think that everything's all hunky-dory. Okay, anybody with any last questions before we go into the deeper subject, give me a call. Let us right now, K2RIW.
WGB with a comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, just to express the value of what Mel was doing with Mel's Corner, today I had to travel quite a distance to issue a VE exam for 20 first responders. And I look at their achievement today. 17 of them failed. Miserable. Now, these are intelligent people. 3 passed. Just passed. And I look at the questions that these young guys and girls are asking us that are really interested and really cracking the books. Now, these responders had 4 months to study for the test. There was no reason for the failure. This is only technician's test is given today. They have to be techs within 6 months or they're going to lose their position on the rescue. They'll be sent to something else. They have to become hands. That's what they want. But it just goes to show you, when somebody has that that desire, you can't stop them. And I really appreciate what Mel was doing with these younger people, because they were really out there trying, and I think it pays to give them the information you do. And they really do appreciate it. Back to you, Dick.
Now, you're saying something that I'm misunderstanding. When you talk about first responders, it sounds to me like people doing ambulance and fire department and that kind of work, EMT-type work. And oh, these guys also want to be hands. Now, when it comes to the volunteer examiner testing scenarios that ham radio operators normally go to, I usually hear numbers like 85 or 90% of them pass the test. And you're saying 17 out of 20 did not pass. So the portion that they did not pass, are we talking about technician and general class ham radio exam, or are we talking about EMT questions? Give me some typical questions that were being responded in an erroneous manner. Over to you, Paul. Now, here we go, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. No, Dick, this was just the technician class, section 2. You know that test is not that difficult. And 4 months to study, they have the IQ. These are bright people. They're EMTs or whatever. Now, there's a certain group that's going to be responding in very dangerous situations. They want them to be ham radios because they're going to have portables with them that are on the ham bands to communicate between them, not to use the radio frequencies that are assigned just for the medical transports and things like that. So that was such a miserable failure, and I don't think there was any reason for it. It's just they weren't paying attention to it. They didn't do their homework, and I compare that to these struggling youngsters, and I just say, wow, that's fantastic. But that was right. 17 out of 20 did, and they failed miserably. I'm talking with 20 questions wrong, some of them only 9 of them right, and the ones that did pass the 3 passed by the skin of their teeth.
There were some very good study guides for the ham radio exam. I can't think of the names of them right now. One of them is the West Coast one, and one from ARRL. And the question pool, I mean, when you expose yourself to the real material, and even if you're just using pure memorization, it is my past experience that passing the exam is relatively easy. I first passed my general class exam not understanding what is a ampere, a volt, a Gilbert, and all these other terms. It was just pure memorization. It was later on I find out what all these terms really meant. So, did these people use the wrong study guide? Did they use no study guide at all? Or did they even have the study guide but just not paying any attention to it? What's your guess as to what happened? Because that's an extremely unusual rate of failure by my standards. And the people in Staten Island are fairly affluent crew, so that doesn't explain it. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
I think it wasn't on Staten Island. I had to travel quite a few miles to issue this test. I actually interviewed them. They worked on Ham Test Online, which is an excellent system. That's about one of the best. Then a lot of them had the ARRL books, and some of them had the CDs. And they said they studied. I don't believe it. I think they took cursory views and just didn't take the test serious. That's the only thing I can think of. And like I say, these people were well-spoken, and, well, you know the level of these people. They're a little bit above average, but they just, I don't think they had the interest or the desire.
The amount of medical information and first responder and quick response characteristics and whatever that a person has to study, tremendous amount of information in order to not create any harm, to do more benefit than harm when you've got somebody with a really serious trauma. You've got a guy in an automobile accident where a chunk of steel has gone through his body, and you use the jaws of life to extract him from that car, and he's bleeding profusely, and he's got a bunch of broken bones and concussions and everything else. The things that you've got to study and do correctly are a very large number. And so an EMT putting 95% of his effort into that area, and the electronics is secondary, maybe that's part of the explanation, as I see it, John. Is that possibly what was going on? Because a pure ham type studying the ham radio materials tends to do very well, but they're concentrating on one area. I'm beginning to think that they were overwhelmed by the medical requirement of this particular position. That's a guess on my part. Back to you, John, KQRIW.
Well, two of them were doctors. One of them failed. They already had their medical training, and they've been doing that for quite a while. I know they have to keep refreshing, but that should be secondary. They should be into their work field and used to doing what they're doing. I mean, they were average age, about maybe 35, 37 in that area, the average age. There really were no youngsters in there. So they're work should be already established and the knowledge they need. They should have had time, but maybe they were, you know, watching a little too much television, or maybe they just took it too lightly. I have no answer for it. It was a miserable failure. I don't mind doing it because we've gotten ham radio from like 600,000 in America to almost 700,000. So it is going up, and I don't understand it because the price of the rigs are going up too.
You've looked at those questions, John. Do you believe that the questions on this particular test were more tricky, more ambiguous, or does that not explain it? Was there anything in particular about this particular question pool I'm almost positive you're going to say no. These are just ordinary questions, multiple choice. And if you knew how to calculate the difference between frequency and wavelength, you couldn't get it wrong. Over to you, John.
Worse than that, Dick, as you know, you have, let's say you have four answers. Two of them are usually obtuse. They were close. There were mostly rules and regulations on the tech test, as you know. They didn't even get into anything complicated. It's the new pool that was brought out, but they had plenty of time to study the new pool. So it behooves me to understand what happened there. I believe it was just lack of paying attention and not doing their homework. You know yourself, you have to set aside even an hour a week. You'd be surprised when you really sit down and do something for an hour a week. It becomes second nature. Back to you, Dick.
Have enough, please.
Go ahead, Fred.
As a VE, I've never had an experience like that. Normally almost everybody passes on the tech test, and I had a daughter who read the book the day before and passed. So it can't be that. But what I do is I have a suggested method of study, which I promoted for years, but it's based on the physiology of learning. And it's called the watching TV method of learning, where you take the book and you have it sit in your lap and you watch TV, and each commercial you do one question. And then when the commercial's end, you go back and you watch the TV. It turns out that your brain really can absorb information in little bits at a time. In fact, you should never try to learn for more than 20 minutes at a time, which is the point of total saturation. But if you do this in a little bit, and while you're doing it, you'll notice on the test there'll be four or five questions sometimes on one concept. So what you want to do is think about the concept. And once you've gone through that, you do it twice. You've got to go through it a couple of times over a two-week period. It takes about 2 weeks for information to migrate from short-term to long-term memory, moderated by the hippocampus. And also remember, your hippocampus is producing new neurons continuously. And a neuron that is not used in 2 weeks gets discarded. So if you have a systematic way of doing it, you can learn damn near anything. Over to the Dick. K1FC.
I've got worse news for you, Dick.
That's some good information there, Fred. Also, there was a Nova special on what happens with short-term and long-term memory. That if at the time you learn new material or you're exposed to new material, if something scares the daylights out of you so that a whole lot of adrenaline flows into your body, that particular memory gets burned into memory. So a new experience that is frightening is something that can really be remembered for a long period of time. And how you do that when you want to learn something, I guess you got to be scared of the test you're about to take to better learn the material. But learning it in chunks, ordinarily a person would be scared to say, gee, if you really want to learn something, turn off the television set. And you're saying leave the television on, but just use learning the new material during the advertisements. I guess turn off the sound during the advertisement and study the new material. But I agree with you, beyond 10 or 20 minutes, you're not really learning a great deal. I did do a fairly careful study. Let me drop. Inadvertently, I did a lot of study in my teenage years when I was studying the Morse code for the first time. Me and a buddy we built ourselves a code practice oscillator. We were sending Morse code back and forth to each other. And we would study for sometimes 5 minutes, sometimes half an hour, sometimes an hour. And we noticed that during the study of the Morse code, during the sending and receiving, there was essentially no change in speed. But over the 24-hour period, it came back the next morning, and all of a sudden your speed was faster. The mind worked on it overnight. But during the period of the study, the Morse code didn't increase. So learning is a peculiar thing. What's your additional information, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Well, you're right about the learning from fear, because when people stick their wet fingers in a socket, now they fear it. But we gave a two-hour seminar covering most of the questions before the test. So that even makes it worse. So I have a total misunderstanding of what the hell happened there. But they'll try again probably in another month or two. I would suggest 2 months. So just another point of information for you.
John, you said you had to travel quite a few miles from your house to conduct this exam. Is there anything in particular of the particular community you went to? I'm beginning to think the answer has got to be no. These are generally educated people. Some of them were physicians. So it had nothing to do with a particular community. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
That's true, Dick. It was affluent community. There was no nobody there from a tough situation. They were well-heeled people.
Boy, that is a strange one. Do you believe that those 17 people who didn't pass have been humbled by this experience? Hopefully they're not going to give up and say it's impossible. They're now going to try a little harder and realize they didn't put proper effort into this one. What do you believe was their attitude as they left that room, John? Go ahead.
Well, I tried to bolster them and help them out and explain to them it was their first time. But the ones who failed by maybe like 5 points, 6 points, which is a lot, they took the test. We had six of them take the test three times. Same technician test, different format, different questions, but the same technician's test. And they still failed. So it was like there was no hope. And I told them, don't get disappointed. You know, you have some of them that may be just nervous. Then you have other people who are bright but just not good test takers. That's the other end. There are some people that just fly on tests, but they can't park a bicycle. So the humans are complicated. That's why I try not to deal with too many human problems. My test equipment doesn't lie to me if I use it properly. You know what I mean. Back to you, Dick.
Now, earlier tonight, you said an exciting statement, and that is, you saw somebody using high voltage on a piece of equipment in your laboratory, and you tried to modify what they were doing because what they were doing you thought was dangerous. Run a little bit of that by you again, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, you know, Dick, you know that I've worked with extremely high voltages, very heavy power, and it's scary stuff. Wesley is unsafe. He's going to be unhappy that I said that because he keeps telling me he's been doing this 3 years and that 3 years. But that's how people get dead. And I'm very uncomfortable when somebody does something that's unsafe. And there's no reason to do it. I grant you that when you're doing experiments, you may not have the proper thing you need and you improvise. But you must realize as you improvise, there's no backup proof that is safe. It's an experiment. You have to be extremely more careful. So when he does that, I get very upset.
You and I have recently had a number of discussions on methods of measuring very high voltages in a safe manner and getting reasonably accurate results. 10% of error I would tolerate. 90% accuracy is probably good enough. And so I own a very high voltage static voltmeter, electrostatic voltmeter, that goes to 30 kilovolts. But you and I own a Wimhurst machine that can probably put out well above 100,000 and maybe closer to 200,000 volts. I suddenly look through all the equipment I own and I realize I've got this thing called a 3M static meter, model 703 static meter made by the 3M company. The whole intention of this thing is to be able to measure static electric charges that might exist on a desk or a peeled piece of cellophane tape or whatever when you're operating around electrostatic sensitive electronics, solid state electronics. Let me drop. The good news is that the 3M brand name, model 703 static meter, says it's good to 200,000 volts. It's a non-contacting meter. The thing looks like a pistol, except that it's got a barrel that's almost 2 inches in diameter on the pistol. And you aim this pistol, on the front end of the pistol, you've got three different apertures that are either a 10th, 1, or 10 to 1 multiplying factor. On the back of it is the Dawson valve movement. It's got a pair of 9-volt batteries inside. You squeeze the trigger, you aim it at the thing. I'm not sure what the desired distance you're supposed to hold it in front of a high voltage, and it tells you how much electrostatic field is near that particular object. I know that the front end of my cathode ray tube on my television set is probably at plus 28 kilovolts, and when I hold this meter near my television set, the thing reads negative 30 kilovolts, not positive, so that strikes me kind of strange. When I read all the labels on the thing, it says it contains radioactive material, H3 tritium, 200 millicuries of H3 tritium. You're not supposed to take the thing apart. You're supposed to treat it with tender loving care and dispose of it safely and whatever. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is the machine, let me drop it. I think the machine was built roughly 1985. That makes it, 26 years ago. I went and looked up H3 tritium today, and I found out it's got a half-life of 12 and a half years. So this thing is two or three times its half-life downrange, and so the nuclear material inside is probably 80% dissipated. That's going to affect the sensitivity, and maybe that's part of the reason why it reads negative. And I'd like to know whether or not there's a way of recharging it, but I wonder if you ever heard of such a meter. I started looking it up at the Internet, and they sell much more modern machines with later serial numbers by the 3M company that measure static voltages. But I'd like to find out more about this ancient piece of equipment and find out what's really going on in the theory of operation. I wonder if you ever heard of anything like that. Because if I can get this thing operating and make it accurate, it's kind of handy that I don't have to touch, and it can, by remote means, some number of inches away, measure up to 200 kilovolts is what it says. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It would be nice to get a new element for that, and I don't think you'd have to recalibrate it. I'm wondering, I think the smoke detectors use the same element in their ionization chamber, but I've never used one of those, but I've seen them used in intrinsically safe testing for that specific reason, but I've never used one myself. But I think you could probably bring that back to life, Dave. But I believe you're right. If it's 12-year half-life, yeah, you're that old. I wouldn't trust it. I wonder why that would make it read negative. That's a question. Don't know. Back to you, Dick.
Anyone have to take?
Yeah, I'm going to pass it to John first and then over to Fred in that order. If tritium-3, H3 tritium, which is the third kind of hydrogen, is the radioactive kind. If that's what's used in smoke detectors, and if that's got a half-life of 12 years, does that mean something like 12 to 20 years is the maximum life you should get out of a smoke detector? I've never heard anybody say that a smoke detector has a finite life, but it's obvious that it should have. What's your feeling on that one, John?
Yes, I think the listed life, they want you to change it in 5 years, whether that's for the manufacturer or for your own safety, I don't know, but I think the smoke detector is supposed to be replaced every 5 years.
Carbon monoxide detectors, Dick, every 7 years, according to Kidder. KB2DTV clear.
TJF on frequency.
TJF, you're on the list. TJF, okay. K1FC is next. Very fine, Jerry. 7.5 years on a carbon monoxide detector. Boy, my smoke detectors in my house are much older than that. My carbon monoxide detector is much older than that. Oh, well. Hey, Fred, we're putting ourselves at risk here. K1FC, wait for the 4-beep. K2RIW.
On all smoke detectors I've seen, they use americium, not tritium. There are other reasons for recommending replacements of the comment that carbon monoxide detectors, which work differently, and I think Kitty just came out with one that they claim is good for 7 years, because there's a chemical detection system that gets fatigued, essentially, or degrades with time, and you want to make sure it's good. Would you say the front of the CRT, I think you should be getting a negative. the electrons are being accelerated. The anode, of course, is positive, but now on the face of the CRT is where the electrons have all ended up, and they are a negative charge. So I would think that you would, that this thing detecting negative would be correct. Over you, Dick.
I look at the other way around now, Fred. Those electrons coming out of the cathode ray tube gun assembly in the back of this cathode ray tube are electrons. They get attracted to a positive charge. That screen that they're going toward has to be plus 28 kilovolts or they ain't going to go there. So the whole front of the set, the viewable portion, the phosphor and everything else, not counting the insulation of the glass that's between me and the real network inside, it's got to be positive. Even though it's being hit by negative electrons, it's got to be positive or the electrons wouldn't go there. Now, americium, if you think that's what's used in smoke detectors, get any idea what the half-life of that is, Fred? Go ahead.
No, I don't. I think it's a fairly long time, but I still think that you would find a negative charge because the positive charge doesn't have to be at the front. It's used as an accelerant, and they're basically... you know, they're attracted from where they are. There's a shield around the thing which has a positive charge. And then they're like bullets out of a gun when they hit the phosphor in the front. And that's where they end up, so I think you should get a negative charge.
Well, turns out that John and I both have an experiment that gives the opposite answer, Fred. We both own a Wimshurst machine, and periodically it's a little bit persnickety. It doesn't want to start up. I put the lead of the Wimshurst machine that I want to become positive. I touch it to the front screen of my operating cathode ray tube television set, and it does become positive. So I'm convinced there is a positive charge on the front end of that television set, obvious by the way my Wimshurst machine behaves. So... there's a mystery to be resolved here. Mr. Tango Juliet Foxtrot, give us your full call and name, and then proceed with your comment, sir. KQLIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, this is Whiskey Alpha 2 Papa Juliet Foxtrot. My name is Vito, here in Bayshore. I'm retired from the telephone company a long time, but I'm 15 years with the Home Depot now, in electrical department, and... we do have a section in the store for carbon monoxide and fire alarms. And there's a particular item that makes the statement on the package that you never need to change the battery for the life of this piece of equipment. Now, the battery is a lithium battery that is supplied with the item, and which has a life expectancy of about 10 years, according to the packaging. So what they're telling us is that in 10 years, you need to throw this item in the trash can. Although 5 and 750 are a good norm, but 10 is a maximum, and there are systems out there that, or items of this nature, carbon monoxide, smoke, and et cetera, that do or are in service up to about 10 years before they are no longer of any value. So just a FYI, if it means anything, just want to throw that in when I was reading the mail. So back to you, Dick. This is WA2, Papa, Juliet, Foxtrot, Vito, Bayshore.
Very fine, Vito. Awful glad you signed in. So I'm going to run that by again. When it comes to the carbon monoxide detector sold by Home Depot, one of the models, it is a lifetime battery inside, good for possibly as much as 10 years. Wild. Is there also a smoke detector of a similar nature? In other words, can I buy a smoke detector as well as a carbon monoxide detector, both of which have a lithium battery, good for at least 7 and maybe 10 years, and therefore I never have to do a battery replacement? Is that the more expensive? Is that the Cadillac model, or is that the popular model being sold these days, Vito? WA2PJF, K2LIW. You got it, Vito. Wait for the four beeps.
Okay. The situation is as follows. No, It's not a matter of the item of being of better quality. Yes, there are smoke detectors that are dual chamber versus single chamber, which make them a little more sensitive, a little better quality, slightly better quality in construction, but they're about the same. There are, of course, the real cheapo ones, too, for $12, but we have some $27 up to about $40, $50, in that range. The you can take any one of these alarms and replace the given battery in the package, which is a one-year battery or 9 months or whatever it may be, with a lithium. Now, I have a wired alarm and fire alarm system in my home, but I also have many self-contained individual smoke detectors on the ceilings in places where the wiring does not pass through. And I replaced all of those batteries with lithium. So, guessing, and I'm hoping I'm guessing correctly, according to the packaging, once again, at the risk of being repetitious in saying that, I should have around 10 years before the battery needs to be replaced, because every 9 months, 10 months, you hear beep, beep, telling you it's time to change the battery. So, that's what I did. Now, because many people, let me give the repeater a break. Many people have lost their lives because they have taken out that battery that beeps after 9 or 10 months or a year and not replaced it. So, to try to save lives, they're instituting, they're enforcing or trying to enforce or bring to the attention of those individuals that go with the better battery and forget about it for a while. So this is what's happening, excuse me, with that. The thing with the carbon monoxide, it's supposed to be mounted on the wall at least 16 inches down from the ceiling and further down if necessary. And the smoke and fire alarms, of course, are meant to be on ceiling. We do carry a combined item together, and people want to buy this to save a few dollars and say, well, I have both in one, I'm good to go. And I say to them, where do you place this thing? I don't know. One's on the ceiling, one's on the wall. Where does this one go? So they say, well, I'll put it on the ceiling. But, all right. But I never understood why any manufacturer would build a combined unit when they are supposed to be placed in two different places, two different locations entirely. So I more or less talked them out of that. I know it costs a few dollars more, but I tell them you need to bite the bullet once in a while and just go for it, because you can't put a price on safety, for one thing, and it is a safety item. So this is a situation as we speak. So back to you, Dick.
You're giving us some darn good information, Vito. Again, I'm awful glad you signed in. Yep. I think carbon monoxide is a heavier gas. Therefore, the carbon monoxide detector should be lower, closer to the ground. The effluent from a flame is a hot gas, which is going to go closer to the ceiling, so your smoke detector should be closer to the ceiling. You told us you're using a wired smoke detector and maybe a wired carbon monoxide detector. I wonder if there's a standby battery in your wired detectors, Vito, just in case your power fails at the same time that the electricity goes out. Is there a battery backup, or if you lose power, of course, maybe by the fire, that your detector no longer can respond? Over to you, Vito. And by the way, you might also mention which Home Depot in which town do you work at? I'd like to visit you one of these days. WA2PJF, K2RIW.
Yes, okay, Dick. I'm here in Bay Shore, the one on Sunrise Highway, right across the parking lot from ShopRite. And I only work part-time, no longer full-time. I work Wednesdays and Saturdays as a norm, usually on Wednesdays 6 to 3, and Saturdays could be anything. But I am striving continuously to work only one day, being Saturday. But anyway, that's primarily when I'm there. You can always call the store to inquire if I'm in at that time, if you should decide to come by. I live right down the street from the store. I walk there in 10 minutes. You mentioned about my system. Mine has a panel. I have one closet all filled with alarm equipment. I used to install alarms many years ago. Found in the detector. It will be found in the panel, which, in fact, just last night I replaced the battery, which I haven't done in a while. But the other self-contained systems that I have, and I do have another self-contained carbon monoxide one that stands alone by itself, has a battery backup, it's line voltage, you plug into a receptacle. But the thing about it is that the battery, even though it's there as a backup, current is being drawn from that battery, and the battery has a life, and it dies within a year's time. And it does give that beeping sound, even though the alarm is powered from the AC source. So that one also, I placed a lithium battery in its compartment to alleviate that situation. So that's what it is with those alarms, if I may. Go ahead.
Once again, some good information. It's kind of amazing that a wired smoke detector or wired carbon monoxide detector, which is getting an external source of power and has a built-in backup battery, still that battery will beep at you. I'm wondering, does the circuit really draw the current from the battery, or is it just the normal shelf life of the battery itself? That's not a clear one, of course. Sounds like you got a real good system there with a panel with your batteries and the way of feeding all of these wired detectors in your house.
Comment, Dick.
Sounds like you got a pretty good system there. Over to you, John, for the comment.
Well, in New York City, any new smoke detector that's put in has to be wired. Now, the battery is still in that unit. If you turn the circuit breaker off and kill it, that battery will beep with a certain rhythm, a certain frequency, to let you know that the AC power went off. It will also still work as a smoke detector. So you can't defeat the unit because a lot of tenants will remove the battery, which will cause the unit to beep because it's on power. And if they remove the battery and turn the power off, well, you know, then shame on them. But and being a fireman, he knows how smoke travels. And let me tell you, he's absolutely right. That CO detector belongs low to the floor, 16 inches, 20 inches. Smoke detector belongs where the venturis happen, at stairways, outside of, up in the hallways. Very important. So, yeah, that's a lot of good information there. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let me run the back to you again, John. Why in the world, if a person has a wired smoke detector that has a built-in battery, and the battery is only going to beep at you when the power is lost, under those conditions, why in the world would a person remove that battery? Sounds like a really risky thing to do. Back to you, John.
Well, I have tenants, and when they cook, they make a little smoke. Of course, the smoke detector goes off, and it annoys them. So they wind up defeating it. And, you know, I try to explain it to them, but some people just don't listen. And any fireman knows that. Also, Dick, I don't know about CO detectors, but smoke detectors, you can buy a thing called can of smoke. I don't know if Depot sells that, but it tells you a specific distance to be away. You give it a little pulse, and that'll tell you if your 5-year-old or 7-year-old detector is still working. You know, you put a new battery in it, give it a test. If it passes, that smoke detector is good, because that's a particle of combustion type of ionization chamber in there. I don't know what they use in it in the CO detectors.
Let's find out if Vito sells that. Vito, to your knowledge, do you sell a can of smoke by which you can do a acid test of a smoke detector? Over to you, Vito.
Well, we sold past tense an item that was, it looked like a piece of rope, actually, and you lit it with a match as you would a cigarette, and that or those fumes would more or less be placed near an alarm or in the vicinity of an alarm, and that would test it. We don't have them anymore for some unknown reason. You see, at Home Depot, there's a philosophy, a ruling, it's called evilocity. Evilocity means that at the rate that an item is sold off the shelf will determine if that item is replaced. and it may have had a very slow or low E velocity, and therefore it was discontinued. There was something else I was going to tell you about something else. I forgot what it was now. Anyway, but all these alarms, we...